Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company v. Sawyer. Mr. Justice Jackson, concurring in the judgment and opinion of the court. That comprehensive and undefined presidential powers hold both practical advantages and grave dangers for the country will impress anyone who has served as a legal advisor to a president in time of transition and public anxiety. While an interval of detached reflection may temper teachings of that experience, they probably are a more realistic influence on my views than the conventional materials of judicial decision, which seem unduly to accentuate doctrine and legal fiction. But as we approach the question of presidential power, we have overcome mental hazards by recognizing them. The opinions of judges, no less than executives and publicists, often suffer the infirmity of confusing the issue of a power's validity with the cause it is invoked to promote, of confounding the permanent executive office with its temporary occupant. The tendency is strong to emphasize transient results upon policies, such as wages or stabilization, and lose sight of enduring consequences upon the balanced power structure of our republic. A judge, like an executive advisor, may be surprised at the poverty of really useful and unambiguous authority applicable to concrete problems of executive power as they actually present themselves. Just what our forefathers did envision, or would have envisioned had they foreseen modern conditions, must be divined from materials almost as enigmatic as the dreams Joseph was called upon to interpret for Pharaoh. A century and a half of partisan debate and scholarly speculation yields no net result, but only supplies more or less apt quotations from respected sources on each side of any question. They largely cancel each other, and court decisions are indecisive because of the judicial practice of dealing with the largest questions in the most narrow way. The actual art of governing under our Constitution does not and cannot conform to judicial definitions of the power of any of its branches based on isolated clauses or even single articles torn from context. While the Constitution diffuses power the better to secure liberty, it also contemplates that practice will integrate the dispersed powers into a workable government. It enjoins upon its branches separateness but interdependence, autonomy but reciprocity. Presidential powers are not fixed, but fluctuate depending upon their disjunction or conjunction with those of Congress. We may well begin by a somewhat oversimplified grouping of practical situations in which a president may doubt or others may challenge his powers, and by distinguishing roughly the legal consequences of this factor of relativity. One, when the president acts pursuant to an express or implied authorization of Congress, his authority is at its maximum, for it includes all that he possesses in his own right, plus all that Congress can delegate. In these circumstances, and in these only, may he be said, for what it may be worth, to personify the federal sovereignty. If his act is held unconstitutional under these circumstances, it usually means that the federal government as an undivided whole lacks power. A seizure executed by the president pursuant to an act of Congress would be supported by the strongest of presumptions and the widest latitude of judicial interpretation, and the burden of persuasion would rest heavily upon any who might attack it. Two, when the president acts in absence of either a congressional grant or denial of authority, he can only rely upon his own independent powers. But there is a zone of twilight in which he and Congress may have concurrent authority or in which its distribution is uncertain. Therefore, congressional inertia, indifference, or quiescence may sometimes, at least as a practical matter, enable, if not invite, measures on independent presidential responsibility. In this area, any actual test of power is likely to depend on the imperatives of events and contemporary imponderables, rather than on abstract theories of law. Three, when the president takes measures incompatible with the expressed or implied will of Congress, his power is at its lowest ebb, for then he can rely only upon his own constitutional powers minus any constitutional powers of Congress over the matter. Courts can sustain exclusive presidential control in such a case only by disabling the Congress from acting upon the subject. presidential claim to a power at once so conclusive and preclusive must be scrutinized with caution, for what is at stake is the equilibrium established by our constitutional system. Into which of these classifications does this executive seizure of the steel industry fit? It is eliminated from the first by admission, for it is conceded that no congressional authorization exists for this seizure. That takes away also the support of the many precedents and declarations which were made in relation and must be confined to this category. Can it then be defended under flexible tests available to the second category? It seems clearly eliminated from that class because Congress has not left seizure of private property an open field, but has covered it by three statutory policies inconsistent with this seizure. In cases where the purpose is to supply needs of the government itself, two courses are provided. One, seizure of a plant which fails to comply with obligatory orders placed by the government. Another, condemnation of facilities, including temporary use under the power of eminent domain. The third is applicable where the general economy of the country that is to be protected rather than exclusive governmental interests. None of these were invoked. In choosing a different and inconsistent way of his own, the president cannot claim that it is necessitated or invited by the failure of Congress to legislate upon the occasions, grounds, and methods for seizure of industrial properties. This leaves the current seizure to be justified only by the severe tests under the third grouping, where it can be supported only by any remainder of executive power after subtraction of such powers as Congress may have over the subject. In short, we can sustain the president only by holding that seizure of such strike-bound industries is within his domain and beyond control by Congress. Thus, this court's first review of such seizures occurs under circumstances which leave presidential power most vulnerable to attack and in the least favorable of possible constitutional postures. I did not suppose, and I'm not persuaded, that history leaves it open to question, at least in the courts, that the executive branch, like the federal government as a whole, possesses only delegated powers. The purpose of the Constitution was not only to grant power, but to keep it from getting out of hand. However, because the president does not enjoy unmentioned powers, does not mean that the mentioned ones should be narrowed by a niggardly construction. Some clauses could be made almost unworkable as well as immutable by refusal to indulge some latitude of interpretation for changing times. I have heretofore and do now give to the enumerated powers the scope and elasticity afforded by what seem to be reasonable practical implications instead of the rigidity dictated by doctrinaire textualism. The Solicitor General seeks the power of seizure in three clauses of the executive article. The first reading, the executive power shall be vested in the President of the United States of America. Lest I be thought to exaggerate, I quote the interpretation which his brief puts upon it. In our view, this clause constitutes a grant of all the executive powers of which the government is capable. If that be true, it's difficult to see why the forefathers bothered to add several specific items, including some trifling ones. The example of such unlimited executive power that must have most impressed the forefathers was the prerogative exercised by George III, and the description of its evils in the Declaration of Independence leads me to doubt that they were creating their new executive in his image. Continental European examples were no more appealing, and if we seek instruction from our own times, we can match it only from the executive powers in those governments we disparagingly describe as totalitarian. I cannot accept the view that this clause is a grant in bulk of all conceivable executive power, but regard it as an allocation to the presidential office of the generic powers thereafter stated. The clause on which the government next relies is that the president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States. These cryptic words have given rise to some of the most persistent controversies in our constitutional history. Of course, they imply something more than an empty title, but just what authority goes with the name has plagued presidential advisors who would not waive or narrow it by non-assertion, yet cannot say where it begins or ends. It undoubtedly puts the nation's armed forces under presidential command. Hence, this loose appellation is sometimes advanced as support for any presidential action, internal or external, involving the use of force. The idea being that it vests power to do anything, anywhere, that can be done with an army or navy. That seems to be the logic of the argument tendered at our bar, that the president, having on his own responsibility sent American troops abroad, derives from that act affirmative power to seize the means of producing the supply of steel for them. To quote, "Perhaps the most forceful illustration of the scope of presidential power in this connection is the fact that American troops in Korea, whose safety and effectiveness are so directly involved here, were sent to the field by an exercise of the president's constitutional powers. Thus, it is said, he has invested himself with war powers." I cannot foresee all that it might entail if the court should endorse this argument. Nothing in our Constitution is plainer than that declaration of a war is entrusted only to Congress. Of course, a state of war may, in fact, exist without a formal declaration, but no doctrine that the court could promulgate would seem to be more sinister and alarming than that a president whose conduct of foreign affairs is so largely uncontrolled, and often even is unknown, can vastly enlarge his mastery over the internal affairs of the country by his own commitment of the nation's armed forces to some foreign venture. I do not, however, find it necessary or appropriate to consider the legal status of the Korean enterprise to discountenance argument based on it. Assuming that we are in a war de facto, whether it is or is not a war de jure, does that empower the commander-in-chief to seize industries he thinks necessary to supply our army? The Constitution expressly places in Congress power to raise and support armies and to provide and maintain a navy. This certainly lays upon Congress primary responsibility for supplying the armed forces. Congress alone controls the raising of revenues and their appropriation, and may determine in what manner and by what means they shall be spent for military and naval procurement. I suppose no one would doubt that Congress can take over war supply as a government enterprise. On the other hand, if Congress sees fit to rely on free private enterprise collectively bargaining with free labor for support and maintenance of our armed forces, can the executive, because of lawful disagreements incidental to that process, seize the facility for operation upon government-opposed terms? There are indications that the Constitution did not contemplate that the title Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy will constitute him also Commander-in-Chief of the country, its industries, and its inhabitants. He has no monopoly of war powers, whatever they are. While Congress cannot deprive the President of the command of the Army and Navy, only Congress can provide him an army and navy to command. It is also empowered to make rules for the government and regulation of land and naval forces, by which it may, to some unknown extent, impinge upon even command functions. That military powers of the commander-in-chief were not to supersede representative government of internal affairs seems obvious from the Constitution and from elementary American history. Time out of mind, and even now in many parts of the world, a military commander can seize private housing to shelter his troops. Not so, however, in the United States. For the Third Amendment says, "No soldier shall in time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner prescribed by law." Thus, even in wartime, his seizure of needed military housing must be authorized by Congress. It also was expressly left to Congress to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Such a limitation on the command power, written at a time when the militia, rather than a standing army, was contemplated as the military weapon of the Republic, underscores the Constitution's policy that Congress, not the executive, should control utilization of the war power as an instrument of domestic policy. Congress, fulfilling that function, has authorized the President to use the Army to enforce certain civil rights. On the other hand, Congress has forbidden him to use the Army for the purpose of executing general laws, except when expressly authorized by the Constitution or by Act of Congress. While broad claims under this rubric often have been made, advice to the President in specific matters usually has carried overtones that powers, even under this head, are measured by the command functions usual to the topmost officer of the Army and Navy. Even then, heed has been taken of any efforts of Congress to negative his authority. We should not use this occasion to circumscribe, much less to contract, the lawful role of the President as Commander-in-Chief. I should indulge the widest latitude of interpretation to sustain his exclusive function to command the instruments of national force, at least when turned against the outside world for the security of our society. But when it is turned inward, not because of rebellion, but because of a lawful economic struggle between industry and labor, it should have no such indulgence. His command power is not such an absolute as might be implied from that office in a militaristic system, but is subject to limitations consistent with a constitutional republic whose law and policy-making branch is a representative Congress. The purpose of lodging dual titles in one man was to ensure that the civilian would control the military, not to enable the military to subordinate the presidential office. No penance would ever expiate the sin against free government of holding that a president can escape control of executive powers by law through assuming his military role. What the power of command may include, I do not try to envision, but I think it is not a military prerogative, without support of law, to seize persons or property because they are important or even essential for the military and naval establishment. The third clause in which the Solicitor General finds seizure powers is that he shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. That authority must be matched against the words of the Fifth Amendment, that no person should be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. One gives a governmental authority that reaches so far as there is law. The other gives a private right that authority shall go no farther. These signify about all there is of the principle that ours is a government of laws, not of men, and that we submit to ourselves, and that we submit ourselves to rulers only if under rules. The Solicitor General lastly grounds support of the seizure upon nebulous inherent powers never expressly granted, but said to have accrued to the office from the customs and claims of preceding administrations. The plea for such a resulting power to deal with a crisis or an emergency according to the necessities of the case, the unarticulated assumption being that necessity knows no law. Loose and irresponsible use of adjectives colors all non-legal and much legal discussion of presidential powers. Inherent powers, implied powers, incidental powers, plenary powers, war powers, and emergency powers are used often interchangeably and without fixed or ascertainable meanings. The vagueness and generality of the clauses that set forth presidential powers afford a plausible basis for pressures within and without an administration for presidential action beyond that supported by those whose responsibility it is to defend his actions in court. The claim of inherent and unrestricted presidential powers has long been a persuasive dialectical weapon in political controversy. While it is not surprising that counsel should grasp support from such unadjudicated claims of power, a judge cannot accept self-serving press statements of the attorney for one of the interested parties as authority in answering a constitutional question, even if the advocate was himself. But prudence has counseled that actual reliance on such nebulous claims stop short of provoking a judicial test. The Solicitor General, acknowledging that Congress has never authorized the seizure here, says practice of prior presidents has authorized it. He seeks color of legality from claimed executive precedents, chief of which is President Roosevelt's seizure on June 9, 1941, of the California plant of the North American Aviation Company. Its superficial similarities with the present case upon analysis yield to distinctions so decisive that it cannot be regarded as even a precedent, much less an authority for the present seizure. The appeal, however, that we declare the existence of inherent powers ex necessitate to meet an emergency asks us to do what many think would be wise, although it is something the forefathers omitted. They knew what emergencies were, and knew the pressures they engender for authoritative action, knew, too, how they afford a ready pretext for usurpation. We may also suspect that they suspected that emergency powers would tend to kindle emergencies. Aside from suspension of the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus in time of rebellion or invasion, when the public safety may require it, they made no express provision for exercise of extraordinary authority because of a crisis. I do not think we rightfully may so amend their work, and if we could, I'm not convinced it would be wise to do so, although many modern nations have forthrightly recognized that war and economic crises may upset the normal balance between liberty and authority. Their experience with emergency powers may not be irrelevant to the argument here that we should say that the executive of his own volition can invest himself with undefined emergency powers. Germany, after the First World War, framed the Weimar Constitution, designed to secure her liberties in the Western tradition. However, the President of the Republic, without the concurrence of the Reichstag, was empowered temporarily to suspend any or all individual rights if public safety and order were seriously disturbed or endangered. This proved a temptation to every government, whatever its shade of opinion, and in 13 years, suspension of rights was invoked on more than 250 occasions. Finally, Hitler persuaded President von Hindenburg to suspend all such rights, and they were never restored. The French Republic provided for a very different kind of emergency government known as the state of siege. It differed from the German emergency dictatorship, particularly in that emergency powers could not be assumed at will by the executive, but could only be granted as a parliamentary measure. And it did not, as in Germany, result in a suspension or abrogation of law, but was a legal institution governed by special legal rules and terminable by parliamentary authority. Great Britain also has fought both world wars under a sort of temporary dictatorship created by legislation. As Parliament is not bound by written constitutional limitations, it established a crisis government simply by delegation to its ministers of a larger measure than usual of its own unlimited power, which is exercised under its supervision by ministers whom it may dismiss. This has been called the high water mark in the voluntary surrender of liberty. But as Churchill put it, Parliament stands custodian of these surrendered liberties, and its most sacred duty will be to restore them in their fullness when victory has crowned our exertions and our perseverance. Thus, parliamentary control made emergency powers compatible with freedom. This contemporary foreign experience may be inconclusive as to the wisdom of lodging emergency powers somewhere in a modern government. But it suggests that emergency powers are consistent with free government only when their control is lodged elsewhere than in the executive who exercises them. That is the safeguard that would be nullified by our adoption of the inherent powers formula. Nothing in my experience convinces me that such risks are warranted by any real necessity, although such powers would, of course, be an executive convenience. In the practical working of our government, we already have evolved a technique within the framework of the Constitution by which normal executive powers may be considerably expanded to meet an emergency. Congress may and has granted extraordinary authorities which lie dormant in normal times, but may be called into play by the executive in war or upon proclamation of a national emergency. In 1939, upon congressional request, the Attorney General listed 99 such separate statutory grants by Congress of emergency or wartime executive powers. They were invoked from time to time as the need appeared. Under this procedure, we retain government by law, special temporary law, perhaps, but law nonetheless. The public may know the extent and limitations of the powers that can be asserted, and persons affected may be informed from the statute of their rights and duties. In view of the ease, expedition, and safety with which Congress can grant and has granted large emergency powers, certainly ample to embrace this crisis, I am quite unimpressed with the argument that we should affirm possession of them without statute. Such power either has no beginning or it has no end. If it exists, it needs submit to no legal restraint. I am not alarmed that it would plunge us straightway into dictatorship, but it is at least a step in that wrong direction. As to whether there is imperative necessity for such powers, it is relevant to note the gap that exists between the president's paper powers and his real powers. The Constitution does not disclose the measure of the actual controls wielded by the modern presidential office. That instrument must be understood as an 18th century sketch of a government hoped for, not as a blueprint of the government that is. Vast accretions of federal power eroded from that reserved by the states have magnified the scope of presidential activity. Subtle shifts take place in the centers of real power that do not show on the face of the Constitution. Executive power has the advantage of concentration in a single head in whose choice the whole nation has a part, making him the focus of public hopes and expectations. In drama, magnitude, and finality, his decisions so far overshadow any others that almost alone he fills the public eye and ear. No other personality in public life can begin to compete with him in access to the public mind through modern methods of communications. By his prestige as head of state and his influence upon public opinion, he exerts a leverage upon those who are supposed to check and balance his power, which often cancels their effectiveness. Moreover, the rise of the party system has made a significant extra-constitutional supplement to real executive power. No appraisal of his necessities is realistic, which overlooks that he heads a political system as well as a legal system. Party loyalties and interests, sometimes more binding than law, extend his effective control into branches of government other than his own. And he may often win as a political leader what he cannot command under the Constitution. Indeed, Woodrow Wilson, commenting on the president as leader of both his party and of the nation, observed, "If he rightly interpret the national thought and boldly insist upon it, he is irresistible. His office is anything, he has the sagacity and force to make it." I cannot be brought to believe that this country will suffer if the court refuses further to aggrandize the presidential office, already so potent and so relatively immune from judicial review, at the expense of Congress. But I have no illusion that any decision by this court can keep power in the hands of Congress if it is not wise and timely in meeting its problems. A crisis that challenges the president equally, or perhaps primarily, challenges Congress. If not good law, there was worldly wisdom in the maxim attributed to Napoleon that the tools belong to the man who can use them. We may say that power to legislate for emergencies belongs in the hands of Congress, but only Congress itself can prevent power from slipping through its fingers. The essence of our free government is leave to live by no man's leave underneath the law, to be governed by those impersonal forces which we call law. Our government is fashioned to fulfill this concept so far as humanly possible. The executive, except for recommendation and veto, has no legislative power. The executive action we have here originates in the individual will of the president and represents an exercise of authority without law. No one, perhaps not even the president, knows the limits of the power he may seek to exert in this instance, and the parties affected cannot learn the limit of their rights. We do not know today what powers over labor or property would be claimed to flow from government possession if we should legalize it, what rights to compensation would be claimed or recognized, or on what contingency it would end. With all its defects, delays, and inconveniences, men have discovered no technique for preserving free government except that the executive be under the law and that the law be made by parliamentary deliberations. Such institutions may be destined to pass away, but it is the duty of the court to be last, not first, to give them up.